Hey everyone, it's me, Reed Galen. As you may have noticed, I don't host the Lincoln Project podcast anymore, but I'm so excited to share with you my brand new show, The Homefront. On The Homefront, you'll get the same incisive discourse about the pro-democracy movement from the smartest, most driven people in the fight today. If you're listening to this episode on the Lincoln Project podcast channel, I invite you to subscribe to The Homefront on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. I want to say thank you to all of you in the pro-democracy movement, and I look forward to continuing our American journey together. And now, The Homefront.
Welcome to The Homefront. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back journalist and political reporter, Abigail Tracy. You know her from Inc. Magazine, Forbes, and most recently, Vanity Fair. Today, she's coming to us from Washington, D.C. Abby, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back.
All right, so we're going to talk about the vice presidential debate that will be tomorrow, as everyone is hearing this. But before that, you spent most of last week in New York City at the United Nations. So just tell us, what were you doing there?
Yeah, no, thanks for bringing that up. It was quite the whirlwind of an experience. I was there I moderated a few panels, appeared on a panel as a guest, sort of in my capacity as a member of the media, really talking about sustainability, sustainable development goals at the UN and kind of what that means and sort of the way in which people can use content, media, film, storytelling to raise awareness without kind of overwhelming people about pretty heavy issues, you know, whether it's like climate change or, you know, mental health, all of these things. So kind of the way in which people can, I don't know, use storytelling to get messages across in a way that doesn't just bum people out. And actually,
that doesn't turn it into a BBC
episode. Right. Yeah. That kind of like helps motivate. And, you know, I think the ultimate theme is sort of like people drive these things. And sort of when people can see somebody that they can relate to or connect with, they're going to be more likely to stay interested and stay engaged. And also think that maybe they can incrementally, you know, through their individual goals, individual achievements, kind of help to reach some of these major goals, you know, kind of on the global stage, if that makes sense.
It does. And earlier in the summer, I spoke at a sustainable investing conference I got invited to. And everybody was a little curious as to why I was there, because I am neither sustainable nor an investor.
I'm sure people were curious as to why I was there this last week.
And so I was doing a fireside chat kind of thing, you know, after dinner one night. And these are all very good people. And what I said is, you're very good people and you're trying to do good things. And what you don't understand is that you're part of a much bigger fight than you're aware of, right? Which is the people who are taking you on, who are making this, you know, the ESG goals and sustainable development, all this stuff, seem like communism or wokeism, right? They're part of a much bigger cultural fight and you're a target of theirs and you have to fight back. And, you know, it was interesting talking to some folks. I'm down here in North Carolina, and we were talking about the difference, Abby, between how Republicans and Democrats campaign. And they said, well, Republicans campaign, you know, using dirty tricks. And I said, sometimes. But the difference is that they assert things, right? They tell you this is how it is. Whether it's true or not is often immaterial. Democrats want to give you all the information and hope to God that you infer from what they've told you that you'll make the right decision. And they go, but Democrats don't use dirty tricks. And I'm saying, you don't have to. Like all of the stuff that the Lincoln Project does, right?
Right.
All of the stuff that anybody does pointing out what Donald Trump or J.D. Vance has said, like that's not dirty tricks. They say this stuff out loud. It's up to us to, frankly, you know, take the gloves off and utilize those things in a way that makes an impact. And so I'm not saying you should use dirty tricks. And that's what I said to these sustainable folks is you have to say, here's what we're doing. This is a good thing. We are capitalists, right? And I said, that's the other thing. I said, no one in this room is a socialist. If you were, you wouldn't be investing in something, right? You're not.
Right.
Very few of you are investing in government. That's taxes. Most of you are investing in private funds, in startup companies. I said, so you're at your core, you are market driven. And I said, you have to reorient yourself to two things. One, telling the story of why you're doing something and how there's profit behind it for good. And secondly, when these people come after you, say, I'm not going to do business in Missouri. I'm not going to do business in Texas. And they're like, but you can't say you're not going to do business in Texas. I'm like, why not? Well, it's a big state. Yeah, there's lots of big states. Like, go someplace else. If they don't want your money, don't give it to them.
Right.
And it was funny because these people are all very nice, again. And like so many of my Democratic friends, they're very nice. But once in a while, I'll tell you this, guys, just 36, 35 days out, whatever it is we are, like, you got to stiffen the spine. Right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I was telling Luis, who's our deputy director at the union, you know, even Luke Skywalker carried a lightsaber, right?
Right.
He didn't say, Darth Vader, please go away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I do think one of the themes too, though, and I think Democrats in particular need to be wary of this at times, sort of in their messaging, is kind of around this idea that finger wagging at people doesn't work. It doesn't work. Like being like, you're bad because of this. It's more, and that was kind of a theme that came up like throughout these panels that I was on, really sort of the idea of, okay, how are you actually, what is an actually positive and effective way to message to people, right, to get them to do things? Scolding people doesn't work. Overly doom and gloom doesn't work.
Right.
And so it's kind of, there's a very fine line, and it's easier said than done when I'm on a panel or when I'm right, talking into a podcast, you know what I mean? But
right,
there is, but Democrats have run, you know, run amok in that regard too, kind of being, you know, scoldy. Like nobody also wants that.
If you don't agree with me, it must be because you're not as smart as I am.
Or you don't agree with me, that makes you a bad person. Like that does not work. And I think that's one thing, you know, for anybody really messaging to be aware of. And those were kind of like, you know, these overarching themes of how do you get people to care about issues, especially when everybody's attention span right now is so fleeting. And it's so hard to get anybody to care about anything.
Well, so let's talk about issues. Let's talk about you know, people scolding and otherwise. So tomorrow night we will see the only vice presidential debate between Senator J.D. Vance, who's currently sitting at 18% approval in public polling, and Governor Tim Walz of your home state of Minnesota. This will be on CBS. I believe it again. It'll be 90 minutes. Hot mics, all this other stuff. CBS has made it clear, unlike ABC, that they will not fact check the candidates' statements. And so, you know, Abby, I think this is one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, like we were talking about, Tim Walz is likely to say things that are demonstrably true. And more often accurate, I would say, because he can say what his job will be there to defend Kamala Harris,
right,
and to demonstrate his fit for, you know, his fitness for the job should God forbid something happen, and to defend his own record, because we know that Vance will come after him for his military service. We know that Vance will come after him for, you know, free sex change operations in high school, whatever the insanity is, right? You're a communist. Vance, you know, and Walz will go after Vance on really any of the insane things he says, from, you know, all of the stuff about women. You know, he wants to, quote, free them from the cubicles. He wants to shut down all public schools because they're this hive of Marxism and Leninism. And, you know, they learn 30, as he said on a video I saw last night, they learn 37 genders, but they don't understand that 2 + 2 = 4. And so it will be this, you know, back and forth of barbs and one-liners. And it'll be interesting to see, like, Vance is smarter than Trump intellectually. He's not as talented as Trump politically, and he's also not very likable. So it'll be interesting to see how he goes after Walz, and then it'll be interesting to see how Walz takes his sort of big dad energy thing that we've talked about in Saturday Night Live, who enlisted Jim Gaffigan, another Midwesterner.
Yes.
Which is amazing. Another solid Midwesterner. We're going to see him later this month, or excuse me, in later October. So very excited. The whole family. You can take the whole family to see Jim. It'll be interesting to see how he does that, if he lays back on the aw shucks, or if he leans forward as the football coach, if he takes the position of a public school teacher, which he has been. So it'll be an interesting dynamic between two very different guys.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the interesting things kind of headed into the debate is Walz I don't think he's necessarily setting expectations low or anything like that. But really, you know, there have been a number of articles kind of quoting people who are close to him, who know him, and other individuals like Amy Klobuchar, who have known him for a very long time, kind of talking about this idea that being on the debate stage is not his arena, so to speak. Like, that's not necessarily where he thrives. Like, I do think he's great, like, on the stump, kind of interacting with people one-on-one. It's not really his space. Kind of in contrast, I would argue, to Harris. Like, Harris right. is great on a debate stage. That's kind of where that her prosecutorial roots really shine sure. and sure. come up. So that's not his spot so much, or his strength, so to speak. But then you also have J.D. Vance, who I do believe is, you know, he is more comfortable on the debate stage. But I don't know how much it matters how comfortable right. J.D. Vance is on the debate stage relative to Tim Walz, because the contrast between the two of them, and you mentioned it, Vance struggles with likability. Walz does not. Like, right. so I don't know how much debating and sort of, you know, debate skills right. is going to come into play at all.
No, this is not going to be Lincoln Douglas, right?
Yeah. Like, I think it's going to be more about who comes across as authentic. And I do think that will likely go to Walz over Vance, who like can't order donuts properly and like grabs fist bumps like with his hands. Like, I don't know.
But you know, it's interesting. I have a slightly different take, which is I think you will see the authentic J.D. Vance. I think yeah. that is who he is now. You know, I was talking to some folks, as I mentioned, I'm here in North Carolina, and some of the people were saying, like, do you think J.D. Vance is really this crazy, or do you think he's just super ambitious? And what I said was, I think J.D. Vance, like Tucker Carlson, were riding the ambition train, and were pretty successful at riding that train. But then the crazy train pulled up next to them, going even faster. And the people on the crazy train said, join us. And they're like, oh, that's great. And they jumped, right? So they're headed in the same direction, but for a different reason. Because now Vance is talking in a way that, you know, he's really ideologically MAGA. Trump yeah. isn't. Trump is a vessel for MAGA, but he's not ideological. Vance is espousing things that it's very difficult for even a good politician to dial back some of the things that he says and the way he acts and the mien he carries, you know, and we know that he's, you know, part of this strange, you know, elite Catholic conversion stuff that's going on with Opus Dei and all these other people. And so I think you are going to see the authentic self. But let me just say this, too, is that I think the authenticity, too, will come from the idea that both of these guys come from humble beginnings. The difference, I think, is that Walz has embraced those humble beginnings and is proud of them. And I think Vance is fundamentally ashamed of them. I think he doesn't like to think about the fact that he wrote Hillbilly Elegy and it brought him to this level of, you know, fame and wealth and in notoriety. But I don't think he likes thinking about the fact that that's where he grew up, if that makes sense.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. And I do think you're right. You know, authenticity. How are we really like defining that? Because I think I was probably confusing a little bit authenticity with likability,
of which Vance has none.
Right. He's like, drink a beer with me. I love beer. I think people will drink beer with me because I love beer. Like, that is his vibe.
Right. I know. There's comedians on Instagram who are making their whole careers just on being J.D. Vance. Right. It's just yeah. hilarious.
But you did touch on something that is really, I do think, is really important and critical in this moment, which is that J.D. Vance arguably is a better, more articulate messenger for the MAGA ideology than Donald Trump. Like, Donald Trump yeah. is constantly throwing spaghetti at the wall. And like yeah. what he did was he kind of created, you know, this set of policies, a set of ideas, a set of rhetoric and talking points that really found roots and found traction across the country. Obviously, you know, that's what happened in 2016. That's why we're talking about it today. But like, it is interesting how I do think you're right that Vance has like embraced it and embodies it and believes it, you know, yeah. sort of all of these pieces of spaghetti, like in yeah. a way that Donald Trump like himself doesn't. Donald Trump is just trying to feed a beast and seeing like, okay, what red meat is working right now in this moment. Whereas J.D. Vance, I think, is able to articulate and conceptualize these policies in a way that like Trump has no interest nor real ability to. And in a lot of ways, that's really scary. When it comes to him facing off with Walz, though, on the debate stage, like, I don't know that that is a track he should take at all.
I mean, we should remember, I mean, this is one of those things that we forget, that Trump's endorsement of J.D. Vance in the 2022 Ohio Senate primary got Vance to a 1-point victory in that primary, right? It was a narrow victory. Trump's bump got him over the line for sure. And then, you know, and then he went on to win the Senate race because it's Ohio now and Ohio's gone very red. But this guy, he didn't have to be a very good politician.
Well, and he wasn't. He won by such a slim margin relative to Trump in the state, right? Like he ran well below. So it was like he barely skated out of the primary. And then in the general election, he performed relatively quite poorly.
Right. And but again, it was Ohio, right? It was going to be very difficult for, I mean, a Sherrod Brown, who's up this year, he's been around so long, right? And I think that there are a lot of otherwise probably working class Ohioans who do see him as a good guy, right? That, you know, he's running again against another MAGA goon who's just not a good candidate. So Brown should be okay.
Yeah.
But Vance, you know, Vance was taking Rob Portman's seat, right? Portman, famously one of the, you know, Bush era Republicans who has frankly disappointed the hell out of me because he knew better all this time. And then he slunk into retirement rather than, you know, taking a primary he knew he'd lose. And he has, of course, has said nothing this whole time. And so, yeah, I think that the last pieces we should not forget is that unless this year is markedly different, which it absolutely could be, vice presidential debates don't really matter that much, and the vice presidential choices don't really matter that much. It's just a part of the deal. I would also say that if Vance performs poorly, like Trump might actually say something publicly about how much he hates the guy, because I guarantee you he looks at Don Jr. every day and goes, why did I ever listen to you? I never listened to you because you're a moron, and then you told me to pick this guy, and he's terrible, and he's weird, and he says this crazy shit, and I don't like that he says this crazy shit. Right. Even though it's Trump's stuff. Right. It's just, you know, if Trump's the crazy, the crazy composer, Vance is the conductor. He's the one that makes it all make sense. So it'll be interesting to see. And you're right. I mean, there will be this jockeying for, you know, spin room and who did better and who did what. Nora O'Donnell and Margaret Brennan are going to moderate the debate. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure we'll hear about Gaza. I'm sure we'll hear about the idea that Israel has literally in the course of like 10 days completely decapitated Hezbollah in Lebanon. I'm sure we'll hear about all of the craziness of abortion, and because, you know, the things that Waltz has put into place in Minnesota, I think Minnesotans are broadly okay with, but they are antithetical to Vance and the sort of Project 2025 belief set.
Yeah, I guess kind of to your point, when we're talking about VP debates and sort of the import of them, obviously, we even say it at the presidential level that debates don't necessarily matter. But when we're looking at this and we're looking at, I think back to that poll, you know, that says that, you know, only I think 9% of Americans need to know more or want to know more about Donald Trump. But then you look at how many voters, likely voters, want to learn more about Kamala Harris, and we're in the, well into the double digits in that regard. So when we're looking at the VP debate, how much do you think a responsibility or onus is going to fall to Waltz to kind of fill in the gaps or kind of fill that vacuum around who is Kamala Harris and what is this ticket pitching?
It's a good point, and one I think that's it's worth a couple of minutes on, because you're right. I think that Vance will get his jibes in against Waltz on being a socialist and stolen valor and all that. But the truth is that Vance's job is there to take some more bark off Harris. That's what his job is. And Waltz's job is to do the same to Trump while defending Harris. And so I would say that that is probably true. And look, I would say if I were Tim Waltz, I'd be like, ladies and gentlemen, you want to know weird? Here it is, right? We saw it 2 weeks ago. We see it again tonight. Like, guys, we're looking for calm. We're looking for competence. We're looking for people who are normal and want to help you and help the country move to turn the page. And that's what we're offering. We're turning the page away from this. We do not want or need more of this. And I think he should say what he said at the debate. They are offering an agenda no one asked for.
Right.
Right. It'd be very calm and say, Vice President Harris and I are offering something different and something new, which is how do we fundamentally give Americans the opportunity to climb that economic ladder, right? The chasm in the middle is too big, right? It's grown too wide. We need the ability for the American dream to be real. And all of that, it sounds like pablum, but here's the difference, Abby, is that it's been so long since we've heard it, since we've heard normal people giving us normal political bullshit, right? As opposed to J.D. Vance, which is like, I'm you know, Leonardo DiCaprio with the flamethrower in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Like, I want to burn everything down, right? And there is some purchase for that. There are still, listen, don't get me started on middle-aged white guys, right? Do not get me started on middle-aged white guys. Guys like me, right? I don't get it. I'm going to write about it. Folks can read about it on Substack because it will post by the time you're hearing this. But, you know, the middle-aged white guy, upper income, educated, suburban, right? They hate everybody, and I'm not sure why. But it's one of those things where and we've talked about Dobbs dads. I've got two teenage daughters. Like, no one can want these guys to be in charge of a world where their daughters have to grow up. No one can want these guys where their wives and their sisters and their mothers have to contend with a bunch of goons telling them what they can and can't do. It's antithetical to modern America, but it's also antithetical to, you know, what used to be conservatism, which is, you know, I think Walt summed up in mind your own damn business.
Well, it's interesting too, because I interviewed Tim Walz a while back. I want to say it would probably have been summer 22 now, maybe summer 23. I don't know. Time is a flat circle. But I interviewed him.
Hey, and, time is a flat circle.
And talking to him, you know, it was really obviously in Minnesota, they had Democrats had a trifecta, right? So both both houses and legislature and the governorship. And this is how they were able to pass these really progressive policies and this very progressive agenda. And I interviewed Walz for a piece that I wrote at the time about kind of what they were able to achieve.
And we'll link to that article in the show notes.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. What they were able to achieve. And I, you know, there was this kind of fear or I don't know if it was fear, but there was some like rumbling that people were saying, oh, there's going to be backlash. There's going to be backlash to everything you pass, like all of this stuff. And I was fortunate to interview Walz for the story for Vanity Fair. And he said, hey, I'm not afraid. And this is not verbatim, but he basically said, hey, I'm not afraid until Republicans start running on an actual agenda that isn't rooted in anger and fear. And he was like, try to come at me over getting kids free school lunch. Try to come at me over, you know, tighter gun restrictions in schools. Like, try to, you know what I mean? Like, and that was kind of his thing. And I think we might see some of that energy on stage, just sort of this, hey, a lot of these policies are actually incredibly popular. Like, people want these versus, you know, people don't want Project 2025.
No.
Like, they
don't. And that's why Trump is running like a scalded dog away from it, right?
Right. Yeah. And I, you know, and it's, you know, codifying abortion in the state constitution, all of these things.
Right.
There is popular support behind so many of the policies that, you know, Walz passed in Minnesota. It's a blue state. So that is, that is worth noting here. But also, a lot of the things that they're pushing as a, you know, as a Democratic ticket also have popular support. And again, to your point, Trump and Vance are running as fast as they can, which is not that fast, but like as fast as they can away
Trump
from...
Trump doesn't run. Let's be clear.
Yeah,
Trump doesn't
he
run.
Doesn't run. He doesn't run. Fueled by McDonald's. But they haven't really been able to distance themselves as much as they want from what have proven to be quite unpopular ideas once public awareness of them has come, you know, to fruition.
Well, but that's what we've talked about previously, though, is that they can't really moderate. And they can't modulate because, you know, if a key pillar of Project 2025 is mass deportation and you've had it splashed all over your convention and you've made the othering of immigrants the really cornerstone of your campaign since the moment it started 9 years ago. And then you were just in Wisconsin talking about migrants, you know, rampaging and burning the cities of Wisconsin. I was there this summer. I saw no burning. I saw no rampaging. You know, then it's very difficult to, you can say out of one side of your mouth, I don't believe in this stuff, but then you go out and you say it all day long. And so I, you know, the idea of, you know, the idea of public education. And somebody said this to me yesterday here in North Carolina is, you know, look, I think that public education does need a reset. I don't know what that means other than it should be better than it is now. And that's not a strike at teachers, but probably a system in which the systems, I should say, in which they are forced to operate. Right. But I'll tell you this, getting rid of public education, right, doesn't make any sense either. Not from an educational perspective, not from the kids' perspective, not from the parents' perspective, and not from a community perspective, right? Like, okay, so you're going to close all these schools and turn them into basically like MAGA madrasas? Like, what are you going to do? Who's going to run them, right? You're going to give all that money now. Is every school going to be a charter school? Are you going to regulate these places? Because I can tell you in a state like Utah where I live, Abby, states, even in Utah, right, public education and public schools have a lot of regulations they have to follow based on what the U.S. Department of Education requires. Private schools in Utah have almost no rules they have to follow, right? You know, as far as educational standards, reporting of incidents, all that other stuff, right? Some based on maybe just straight criminality. But for the most part, what they're basically saying is, we want you stupid. We want you stupid. We want your kids stupid. And if they're not going to be stupid, we want them indoctrinated. And that, to me, again, is fundamentally anti-American, right? But I don't think we should underestimate the idea that democracy is not the norm in human history. Democracy is the aberration, right? Most people throughout history have lived under some authoritarian or centralized control. Right. We should not forget that, you know, 100 years ago, 90 years ago, there were lots of places in the world who said, no, we don't want democracy. These were not the leaders. These were the individuals. We want a strong centralized government. We want someone telling us what to do. We want someone leading us. Now, we'll go do our lives, but we're perfectly happy to hand that stuff over. And that, to me, is scary because I think there's a significant portion of the population here in the U.S. that after 9 or 10 years of Trump and 40 or 50 years of right wing action, right, have now come to that place. And that's what worries me.
Well, and look, we're already looking at a scenario wherein we're seeing Donald Trump and his allies already kind of floating these claims again that the election is already undermined, you know, calling right into question the integrity of it. And there are a lot of questions out there as to, okay, what do you do? What do you do now? How do you push back against these claims? And it's scary because it feels like Groundhog Day when we're thinking back to 2020. Like, we've seen this tape before and nobody asked to watch it again, you know?
Right.
And so I guess it's troubling.
Well, but I mean, and I would say this, and I think it's a really good point, is that for all of our friends and allies out there, and anybody who's, you know, any state you live in, when you hear that, right, push back on it. If someone says, oh, they're going to steal it, say it's BS, right? We have had free elections. We are having free elections. We will have free elections, right? The only people who want non-free elections or unfree elections are the people who are now claiming that it's already rigged, right? Because everything from Trump is projection. Everything from MAGA is projection. Because, again, I think it's important, guys, to remember, they don't even want to try and steal it outright. What they want to do is create enough misinformation, disinformation, and confusion that enough people in enough places say, well, how can we be sure who won? So now we won't certify, you know, here. We'll send it to the U.S., you know, to Congress to vote by delegation, a contingent election. Well, of course, that would work out perfectly for them because the way it works is that every state gets one vote. And Republicans, I think, currently hold the majority of delegations, 26 to 22, I think. I might be wrong, but I think it's like that. But it's definitely right. More than one more than they need. And that's the thing, is that they don't care about the reaction. They don't care about the outcome of a decision like that, right? It doesn't matter to them that there would be unrest in the streets. In fact, they see that as the predicate for the things they already say they want to do, which is, if you are going to protest, then we are going to invoke the Insurrection Act because we told you these people would not accept the election, and here they are now not accepting the election. Therefore, for security reasons, we must do these things, right? And so we should never underestimate how good at being bad these people are. Guys,
right.
I'm going to say it. I'm going to say it for the next 5 weeks. Like, guys, they will do anything right? They will do anything. And it is incumbent upon each and every one of us to keep our eyes and ears open. If you want to go be a poll worker in your state or your precinct, go do that. If your state needs a poll watcher, go sign up to be a poll watcher. Guys, we need not only Mark Elias and his lawyers on the ground, but we need every part of an early warning system we can to say, there's something funny going on there. There's something funny going on there. We think there's trouble here, right, guys? It's going to take all of us, right? See something, say something, like we used to say after 9/11, right? Like, they are planning something. The problem is that we're not going to know what it is until they start to deploy it. But if we can pick up those clues along the way, and I can't believe I'm talking like this, Abby, right?
my mom's doing it. My mom, right. she's a election
well,
worker.
Good.
Yeah.
God bless her.
She took some online classes. Be like Delia Flynn in Minnesota.
Be like Delia. Yes. God bless you, Delia. And hello. But like, guys, this is where like every vote's going to count. Every person's going to count. Every American's going to count, because they will do all they can to throw as much sand into the gears to make enough people say it's been stolen, to create some ugliness. And as I've said before, this campaign has two phases, guys. Between now, this moment you're listening to this, and when the polls close on Election Day, and from the moment the polls close until January 20th, 2025. Those are the two phases of this election, right? I hope that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz walk away with this. I hope it is a blowout, so that in 2028, right, if Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are running for re-election, and whoever the Republican is, that we can say, okay, that we know that on election night there will be a free and fair, like the Republican, if they lose, will get up and say, I've just called President Harris and congratulated her on her reelection. Or God forbid, President Harris has said, I have just called Governor so-and-so and congratulated him, because that's how it's supposed to work. How we saw it 4 years ago is not how it's supposed to work.
Right.
It was never supposed to work that way. It hasn't worked that way. Even going back to George Washington, right? But not George Washington so much as John Adams, the second president of the United States. He lost. And you know what he did? He went home. He didn't contest the results. He knew he'd lost to Jefferson. And Jefferson took office and Adams went home, right? And that was the moment we started the peaceful transfer of power, which no one had ever seen, right? And we had it until January 6th, 2021, when it ended. And guys, it's just like 0 days since an attempted insurrection, right? Like at the factory, right? Like, we have to get through this next 35 days, and then we have to get through the 6 or 7 weeks after that, right? Because Trump, this is everything for him. This is everything. All of his past sins, Abby, come to a head if he loses on November 5th.
Right. Well, there's so many kind of concerning rhetorical seeds being planted by individuals, particularly look at Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's talking about this idea of non-citizen voting, which is such a minuscule occurrence. Like, right. It doesn't exist. There's something like, it's like 0.00001% of instances broadly where this actually happens. Even the Heritage Foundation that created Project 2025, they did an analysis over the last years, and they found something like 26 instances of actual non-citizen voting. Like, it's not a thing. It's certainly not a thing, you know, like statistically significant in terms of changing the election.
Right.
And it's not determinative. And that's kind of the key here, right? It's not to say that it doesn't happen or it hasn't happened, but statistically, no, absolutely not. This is not something that is this real concern. You know, you saw the House GOP blow up their stopgap spending bill because he tried to attach this provision to it to say non-citizens, you have to prove citizenship to vote. That's already a thing. Like, and it doesn't happen. But what it is it's creating a narrative, and a narrative that is troubling, and one that potentially, you know, Trump and his allies, should he lose to Harris in November, are likely to latch onto. You know, again, back to this idea of throwing spaghetti at the wall. But the reality is like, the data does not bear it out. The data is not there. But what you are seeing is already, you know, planting the seeds to sow discord.
Well, let me swing to the other side of the spectrum, and let's close on a happy note. So I am here, guys, in North Carolina. Well, I am here recording in North Carolina. By the time you hear this, I will hope to be home. And I was in Chapel Hill. I was in Pittsburgh. and Durham. And what I could tell you is we did an event in Pittsburgh on Saturday night, and we had a panel of three women, and they are the backbone of democracy. Each one of these women had taken it upon themselves, Janice from Red, Wine, and Blue, to make, you know, her area more Democratic, big D Democratic. After the state and local Democratic Party said, there's no votes there. She single-handedly, she and her friends like got together and said, how are we going to do this? And they flipped their entire neighborhood, you know, area from Republicans to Democrats. And then there's Sue, who runs the Chatham County Democratic Party, where I am right now. They had 85% Democratic turnout last time, and she's trying to beat that this time, right? Like, incredible. And, you know, she's out there all day, every day working. And I think it's important to understand, too, these groups are working 24/7, 365. They don't quit after Election Day, right? They go back to work. And so, you know, they are the people who are making this stuff happen. And, you know, this is why what we do at the union is so, I think, incredible and crucial, is that we are taking all these groups who have not had the opportunity to work with one another or be aware of one another or find the bodies that they need, because they're all underfunded. They're all understaffed. They all punch way above their weight. But we can, you know, bring them all together in a hub, give, you know, tens of hundreds of thousands of people the opportunity to say, OK, I want to go work on that, you know, and you can go door to door like I did, or you can do it from your house, whatever it is. But there are plenty of ways to get involved. And guys, your fellow citizens are already doing the work, and all they need is just your help, right, for a few days here and there. And again, if it's Delia working as an election worker,
shout out mom,
poll watcher, shout out mom, right, you can do your part, and I hope you will do your part. And I know that, you know, as scary an occurrence as Pennsylvania was 2 weeks ago, Abby, this was a great experience. We went door to door in a beautiful neighborhood, lots of young families, everybody happy to see us. They didn't, when they saw the word democracy on our t-shirts, they smiled instead of slamming the door in our faces, which is a whole sociological experiment somebody should take on after the fact. but it was great to be here in the great state of North Carolina. I'm going to be at Duke today as we're recording this, talking to some students there, and then off to Michigan. So I will be in Michigan next weekend. So staying on the road. But Abby, before we let you go, first and foremost, thanks again for joining me. But where can everybody find you and your work online?
So you can find me on X at Abigail Tracy and on Instagram and Threads at Abby Tracy. Also, I will say, Reed, I literally yesterday in New York City, sorry, this is just a very quick anecdote. Yesterday in New York City, there was a stopped escalator. The escalator was stopped, and at the top of it was a shoe that got stuck in the mechanism. And there were like four cops like trying to figure out what to do. But I will say that this was proof positive that I am not irrational in my fear of broken escalators. Like, there is something around your shoes getting sucked into these things at times. And so all I'm saying, watch your feet.
And some poor person out there walking around with
shoeless,
one shoe on.
In New York City. Right? Gross.
Shoeless in New York City.
You know, those streets are dirty. So that's what I'm saying.
Safe but dirty.
Safe but dirty.
That's New York City's new slogan. Safe but dirty.
Yes.
And that goes all the way to the mayor's office.
Yes.
all right, guys. As always, go to jointheunion.us. Sign up for any and all of the nearly 2,000 volunteer opportunities we have, and pitch in a few bucks if you can. Please keep us on the road. As always, you can find me on Twitter and TikTok at Reed Galen, on Threads and Instagram at Reed_Galen USA, and on Substack, also at the home front. Abigail Tracy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And everybody else, I'll see you on the road. Have a good one.